You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Haunted Road, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. Listener discretion is advised.
Without further ado, really bring the house down, make some noise for the Haunted Road podcast host, Amy Bruni!
Holy moly, thank you guys. I appreciate it. I'm just making sure everything's working. So as I stated before, I don't know that all of you were in here when I said this, but there is definitely a content warning today. This is a really heavy episode of Haunted Road. I have Kleenex in my pocket. It will be a miracle if I make it through this without crying. So just be ready, okay? So if you haven't heard Haunted Road before, the first half, we delve deep into the history of a haunted location. And then the second half, I interview someone who has knowledge of the hauntings there. And so we talk about the paranormal experiences. So without further ado, let's get started, okay? In some ways, Penhurst Asylum was a paragon of progressive thinking about how to treat people with cognitive disabilities, giving them social support and a safe place to live, where they could be protected from the dangers of a judgmental society presented to their health and safety. To many who had nowhere else to go, it promised to be a dream scenario. But the dream was, well, a dream. Penhurst may have opened with the best of intentions, but it didn't end up that way. In its 79 years of operation, the asylum was characterized by the harshest of patient mistreatment. Its more than 10,000 residents were subjected to what the Philadelphia Inquirer described as medical experimentation, cruel punishments, and constant threats to physical and psychological well-being. Residents were trapped, forced into labor against their will, unable to leave, out of control of the most basic elements of their own lives. And that was the adults. Children under 5 years old were kept in cages, lying in their own filth for days on end. As one newspaper put it in 1972, Penhurst Asylum was the shame of Pennsylvania. Many inmates stayed there as long as 35 years, and some never left. I'm Amy Bruni, and this is Haunted Road. Penhurst Asylum originally opened in 1908 as the Eastern Pennsylvania Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptic. According to the Penhurst Memorial and Preservation Alliance, it was once seen as a model institution. At the time the asylum opened, people with mental illness and cognitive disabilities were called defectives and were dealt with in horrific ways, like forced segregation from society and even sterilization. As the Alliance described in the 1800s, defectives and other dependent, deviant groups, such as aged paupers and the sick poor, were grouped together and sold to the lowest bidder. Built in Spring City, Pennsylvania, Penhurst promised to be the antidote to that kind of treatment. Before the asylum opened, the state legislature organized a commission in 1903 to get a sense of the needs of that underserved population. They found nearly 4,000 residents who were either incarcerated or were in poorhouses or hospitals for the insane, who were all in desperate need of actual care for their conditions. Penhurst was designed to hold 500 people, with room for expansion, but the need far outweighed the space. The asylum was overcrowded almost from the day it opened. Within 5 years of admitting its first patients, Penhurst was under pressure from the legislature to admit immigrants, orphans, and criminals the state did not know how to handle. Pennsylvania created a commission for the care of the feeble-minded, who pushed those with cognitive impairments into Penhurst to prevent them from procreating and passing down their genes, calling them a menace to the peace. Immigrants designated as feeble-minded, immigrants were deemed unfit for American citizenship, and the state demanded they be admitted into custody. In a report to the state, Penhurst's chief physician quoted Henry H. Goddard, a leading eugenicist, by saying, "Every feeble-minded person is a potential criminal. The general public, although more convinced today than ever before that it is a good thing to segregate the idiot or the distinct imbecile, they have not as yet been convinced as to proper treatment of the defective delinquent, which is the brighter and more dangerous individual." As the Philadelphia Inquirer reported, by 1957, the institution had more than 3,500 residents with just 600 staff, from groundskeepers to aides. That number rose to 4,100 patients by the early 1960s. The newspaper further reported that by the 1960s, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was appropriating more than $2 million a year for Penhurst's operations, and the facility's residents were impressed into a forced labor system the Supreme Court would rebuke as peonage, or involuntary servile labor. Residents had lost their fundamental freedoms, including the right to leave or to exercise the most basic of life choices. A local news station aired a documentary in 1968 called "Suffer the Little Children" that laid bare the horrible mistreatment at Penhurst. Among the many horrifying revelations in the documentary was reporter Bill Baldini's discovery that large American zoos were spending more per day to feed their animals than the state spent on the people in the asylum. As the Philadelphia Inquirer described it, the documentary shattered Philadelphians and other Americans' easy complacency and blind indifference to what had been occurring for decades behind institutional walls, far removed from public scrutiny. Baldini later said that he had trouble keeping his camera crew on the documentary shoot because they were literally getting sick from what they saw. Matt Lake, Rusty Tagliarini, and Mark Moran wrote about Penhurst for Weird New Jersey, saying, "On the flickering monochrome televisions of the time came images of full-grown hands and feet bound by straps to adult-sized crib beds. Inmates of the institution were shown rocking, pacing, and twitching. Many were severely disabled, either mentally or physically, but others were quite lucid and coherent, but withdrawn into themselves because of overstimulation of the senses in the loud and sometimes frightening place." When one patient was asked by the interviewer what he would like most in the world, if he could have anything he wanted, the sad and withdrawn reply was simply, "To get out of Penhurst." The documentary caused public outcry and spurred widespread calls for changes to the treatment of and constitutional rights for the mentally disabled. Baldini later told NPR about the horrors he saw in the asylum. "Think of a ward of infants and children from the ages of 6 months to 5 years old," he said. "There are 80 of them in metal cages. These people were literally lying in their own feces for days." According to Weird New Jersey, probably the most chilling scene showed one of the hospital's physicians describing how he dealt with a particularly vicious bully who had brutalized one of his other inmates. He described how he had asked one of his colleagues which injection he could use to cause the most discomfort to a patient without permanently injuring him. Then he proceeded to administer that injection to the bully. That was a common punishment in Pennhurst. Doctors would use what they called harmless but painful injections as recourse for bad behavior, even on children. In 1970, medical sociologist Jim Conroy arrived at Pennhurst to research the developmental disabilities. As he told NPR, "I saw a place with 3,700 people in it that was built for far, far fewer, and I saw things that I will never forget." In 1972, local newspaper The Mercury called Pennhurst the shame of Pennsylvania, describing 1,700 human beings stored away in crumbling warehouses, the urine stench of decades soaked so deeply into the walls and floors that it can never be washed out. About half of the more than 10,000 inmates housed in Pennhurst died there, largely due to patient mistreatment and neglect. In 1974, patient Terry Lee Halderman filed a complaint with the state on behalf of all other Pennhurst residents about their treatment. The complaint alleged that the residents live in inhumane and dangerous conditions, are subjected to unnecessary physical restraints, are given unnecessary and dangerous medication, are consigned to lives of idleness and because of lack of habilitative programs, and are subject to numerous physical injuries resulted from a lack of adequate supervision. The complaint further alleged that this treatment caused Halderman and her class to deteriorate and regress emotionally, intellectually, and physically, and that they were being denied due process and equal protection of the law and inflicted on them cruel and unusual punishment. Unimaginably bad treatment came to light as a result of this case. Patients who were in crisis could go days without seeing a psychologist for treatment. When they were in a crisis situation, they would most likely be restrained through either physical or chemical measures. People could be bound to a bed or a chair or sedated with unusually high doses of psychoactive drugs. According to the Pennhurst Memorial and Preservation Alliance, psychotropic drugs at Pennhurst are often used for control and not for treatment, and the rate of drug use on some of the units is extraordinarily high. In 1978, the court ordered that Pennhurst be closed and that its remaining 1,200 residents be provided living arrangements and support services. To accomplish this, a special master was appointed to supervise the arrangements. The asylum was to stay open until that work was finished. In 1981, Time described the place as having a history of being understaffed, dirty, and violent. The hospital was on its way to closing, but for the patients, it must have seemed like the hell was never coming to an end. By 1983, Pennhurst had 640 patients who had been there an average of 35 years. At that time, the Department of Justice indicted 9 present and former aides for assaulting and abusing patients, including beating patients, some of whom were confined to wheelchairs, and forcing patients to assault each other. A study following patients released from Pennhurst was ordered by the court as part of the hospital's closure. Its results were released in 1985. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the researchers followed 1,154 people who lived at Pennhurst and found that none became homeless or incarcerated. They tended to live at least 6 years longer, and 14% became more independent. Almost all said that they were better off outside of Pennhurst. Despite a reported 19% increase in services, the cost to taxpayers went down by 15% compared to funding Pennhurst. In 1987, the last patient left Pennhurst and the asylum was finally closed. In the 1990s, part of the building briefly served as a veterans home, but was sold to a private developer in the early 2000s under the Pennhurst Memorial and Preservation Alliance. It was added to the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, a worldwide network of historic sites specifically dedicated to remembering struggles for justice. In 2010, part of the campus was reopened as a seasonal haunted attraction, which immediately started pulling in as much as $2 million annually from people eager to experience the place. But given the asylum's dark history, many locals and those previously affiliated with Pennhurst objected to that use, especially since the attraction misrepresented much of what happened there in the past. Reporter Bill Baldini, whose documentary brought the asylum's atrocities to light, and Jim Conroy, the medical sociologist who spoke publicly about his experiences there, said they believe the site shouldn't be trivialized as a haunted house, but rather be a memorial to the past. As Diana M. Katovich wrote for the National Council on Public History, the first version of the haunted asylum was as bad as anticipated. A fictional doctor and his minions were shown experimenting on asylum inmates. In a minor nod to the history of Pennhurst, patrons were able to view artifacts retrieved from the property, notably a dentist chair and electroshock therapy machine. Yet, historical fact and shock fiction were poorly separated, and visitors were left to wonder which was which. The council quoted disability studies historian Sarah Hanley Cousins as saying, "I like a ghost story as much as anyone, but the patients who lived at Pennhurst weren't spooky spirits. They were human beings with complex lives." In 2017, ownership changed, and the new owner and general manager created an environment intended to be more respectful to the disabled community. As Diana Katovich wrote, "Aware of the unintended consequences of a conflated story, they changed features of the attraction and empowered a group of disabled performers with creative control. More than half of the performers, called haunters, identify as disabled. A few even have personal histories of institutionalization. This new haunted asylum turns the original plot on its head. The haunters each assume a fictional identity, and the inmates conspire to take over the asylum from the professionals. The fictional doctors, nurses, and the visitors become the new inmates." Today, Pennhurst offers daytime history tours and overnight paranormal investigations. While many buildings on the campus were deemed unsafe and have been torn down, others are maintained through proceeds of those tours. Jim Ansbach, founder of the Shore Paranormal Research Society, which regularly investigates Pennhurst, says the asylum is rife with paranormal activity. Weird New Jersey wrote that the group has conducted several large-scale investigations of the old asylum's many buildings and documented a variety of evidence of paranormal activity, including photos, videos, recordings of voice phenomena, and personal encounters with spirits. Among the recordings are the sounds of disembodied voices uttering things like, "Go away," "I'll kill you," "We're upset," and "Why did you come here?" An unknown male states, "I'm scared," while an invisible female asks, "Why won't you leave?" In the administration building, investigators have said they've picked up disembodied voices and the sounds of toilets flushing, though there's no running water in the building. In other buildings, people claim to hear children's voices and EVPs of distressed adults. According to Shore, a firefighter, police officer, and a Marine all saw a woman in an old-style nurse's uniform in the Limerick building. Investigators claim to have been touched in the Mayflower building and the Tinicum building, and to have seen shadow figures manifest and dissipate in the Quaker building. These shadows include what appeared to be a girl with long black hair, a hunched-over presence with long dangling arms, and figures poking out from behind obstacles. Doors and a rocking chair have moved on their own, and objects like pry bars and brass fixtures have been observed being thrown by unseen forces. And investigators have also been physically harmed. According to Shore, one was shoved from behind hard enough on a stairway to leave a deep red mark, and another was scratched on the arm.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Now, I have investigated Pennhurst a number of times, including once on live television, where I proceeded to drop an F-bomb while millions of people were watching. So here to talk more about that experience, as well as many others, are two of my dear friends who have also both spent quite some time investigating the asylum, Mr. Aaron Sagers and Mr. Adam Berry.
Welcome, my friends.
Hello.
Oh, no. I didn't turn your microphones on. I didn't want them to actually hear you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
This is Haunted Road. I'm Amy Bruni. May the fourth be with you.
Okay, so real talk. We have investigated Pennhurst quite a few times. Strangely, we're actually going back there next weekend for Paracon, which is going to be cool. It is one of those places I feel like you have to be very cognizant of the history. And I think that we've gotten so much better at that in recent years. I'm sure the first time I investigated there, I was completely guilty of just kind of being like, oh, terrible things happen here. It's super haunted. How cool. And then I actually took the time to watch that documentary. It's on YouTube. And you see what happened there. And it is appalling. So, so just talk a little bit more like, Aaron, you've investigated there many times over the years. What first brought you to Pennhurst?
I think it was actually for an event the very first time I went there. But actually, many years ago, I was working as a reporter at some newspapers in the Philadelphia area. So maybe I went there first for one of their haunted house attractions. Mm-hmm. And even then, honestly, it didn't sit right with me because this is one of those locations that, look, it just has, it's a city of shame. It really is a city, and it has such a dark legacy that it makes you angry when you go there and you're aware of what took place there. And the fact that it also was taking place in my lifetime. Right. I was 10 years old when it closed. So it's this recent history, and it's disgusting. But yeah, the very first time I think I went there was for the haunted house. And the first time I investigated was part of an event.
Okay. Mr. Berry?
I went with someone named Amy Bruni.
I wasn't sure if it was one of your Ghost Hunters Academy locations. No. I never know.
No, but. Waverly, actually, where we're going to.
Oh, yeah.
Was the very first place I ever investigated on television. I mean, you and I investigated that on Ghost Hunters. And, and I remember, you're right. We were in a different mindset in a way. We were excited to get to this incredibly historic haunted location. It was multiple nights, which is a big deal for when we investigated something like that. But I think for us, we didn't know what to expect, right? And you and I, we were in Philadelphia, so we had just started investigation. This is probably a month into us working together.
That's true.
So we were still sort of getting our feet wet on, you know, how we interact with each other and what experiences we will have. But I know that the activity that we had there flipped our brains inside out, because it was really incredible activity. But at that point, I think we didn't know what to do with that information, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think that I think I wrote about one of the experiences we had there in the book, which was, and this happened not on the, was this on the live show when we heard that thing in the closet?
That was on the live show.
So we'll talk about that experience.
Yeah. So Amy and I were in the, I guess it would be the children's section, wherever they said the hard of hearing would be. And I think when we started hearing those kind of thoughts where, oh, the kids were, you know, just, they had a physical disability where they couldn't hear or they couldn't see, they were put in here. To us, I mean, that was already like, what are you talking about? Like, there are schools for the blind and deaf. Like, what are you doing? But we were in that section, and I remember being on the third or fourth floor, and she and I, you know, were slowly walking through to get our bearings, and we started asking questions. And then to the left of us, down the hallway, you could hear what sounded like a footstep and a drag. So it was like step, step, like step, drag. And she and I looked at each other like, what the actual is that? Yeah. And we were looking down this hallway. Nothing was there. And then almost instantaneously after that, we heard what sounded like clawing, like scratching and clawing on wood. And at this point, I think it's on television, but you can go back and watch. But she and I are like on top of each other and like back to back. And we're sort of trying to like figure out where the sound's coming from, what's happening. And we knew that the scratching, it was like a scratch, clawing, scratching, like something trying to get out of something.
It was so incredibly loud.
Terrifying.
It was so loud. I can't overstate how loud it was.
And also your mind starts playing tricks on you because you hear the step drag and I picture horror movie. I picture like the, you know, some person walking down the thing trying to get us. So we had to make our way toward the sound, like any good horror movie. And we pinpointed to this room. We walk into the room. The scratching is still going on. It's louder. We know it's coming in from in front of us, where a closet door is closed.
And we we thought animal. We were like, there's an animal in there. We are about to have our faces torn off by whatever this is. But
and she was like, you open it.
That's true. You were new.
I was new.
You were new.
And so she is standing maybe 5 feet away from the door, and I'm like creeping up on the handle like it's going to pop out. And I take the handle, and I went, and I opened it really quick and jumped back because I was, you know, something rabid is coming out of there. And that did not happen. There was nothing in the closet. There was no signs of rodents. There was no animal droppings. There did not smell of urine. It was just a normal closet. There were no holes in the ceiling. And I think we even used the thermal imaging camera.
I was just going to say, we double checked. We brought the thermal. The one time I enjoyed the thermal, I was like, oh, we can see if there's an animal in here.
And there was no animal, no traces of animal, no signs that an animal was trying to claw out in any section. And we never heard it again, ever. And anywhere else in that building. I mean, yes, of course, it was dilapidated. It could have been an animal, but we checked our boxes for that. And it was wild.
Yeah. No, that was terrifying. And what's so funny is that we were like, oh, phew, it's a ghost.
Yeah. We're like, oh, great. Oh, great. I mean, you know, thinking about that experience now, I sort of wonder what that was, though. Like, you talk about, you know, the young children in cages and people being trapped and tied up. It's like, now when I think about that sound, a sound, it's no longer spooky. It's sad.
It's heartbreaking.
Exactly. Yeah.
Someone was confined and that was their reality. So what would they do? They would.
Well, that's just it. It's like if that, I imagine at some point, someone was probably locked in that closet. Like, I almost think it had to have happened. And so I pray that that is not like their actual consciousness still there trying to leave. And instead it's just kind of like that imprint there. You know what I mean? I would prefer it's just the actual turmoil or emotion left behind, because I would hate to think there's someone just perpetually stuck in this closet, you know?
I don't like to think in terms of children or people being stuck in places. Mm-hmm. And yet I do wonder in facilities like that where people were so physically and emotionally broken, like where they were broken by other people, if there's something about that where they are just lingering there in some form or fashion.
Well, the sad thing to think about is that, you know, they were probably told their entire lives that they weren't meant for anywhere else, you know? And so, it's so ingrained in them that they were not meant to be in society. This is where you are because of how you are. And so when given the choice in death, like, does that mean they carry that, like, I'm not meant to go anywhere but here? It's kind of like sometimes when we investigate jails, I feel like sometimes the inmates are like, it's this kind of, you know, self-imposed sentence. Like, I'm supposed to be here and I can't leave. And I would not be surprised if that's what's happening there and to some extent.
It was official policy too. Like, as early when it opened in 1903, was it? By 1913, there was already official policy about eugenics on the books in Pennhurst. And that not only are you not worth anything, you're not even worth, like, getting out and having a family. You need to be separated. You are dehumanized.
Mm-hmm. Oh, completely.
And when it reaches that point where you're no longer considered human, it makes it all the easier to abuse and hurt and break these people down. Yeah.
When you watch that documentary, and so this is what I think of when I investigate there, I see these faces, and I mean, I haven't watched it in years, but it is permanently ingrained in my brain. And I see the faces of these people, and I think of them as I investigate there. You know, are these the people or people like this who are talking to me? But they were so coherent. They were like talking to anyone in here. They weren't like, it wasn't like they couldn't speak. It wasn't like they were emotionless. Like, they were completely able to have a conversation. They were calm. It's the weirdest thing. And you're like, why are you there? Like, it just didn't make a lot of sense.
No. And I think the first time I saw the documentary was when we went back, maybe even the following year for the live show. And we knew we were going back there. And, you know, we had talked about the documentary and I watched it, and I think that changed the way we investigated that space on live television.
Yeah.
For sure.
100%.
Because we were thinking about it. And if you notice, we went back to that same spot, if you watch that live show, and we were using the flashlights for communication. And we had set three flashlights on the mantle, which was in the room just past where we heard the scratching, down the hall from where we heard the foot dragging. And we would set them upright, like straight up. And, you know, live television, anything can happen. And we like to do the hardest techniques on live television because we're like, you know, we're going to use it. We believe in it. We're going to see what happens. And if it works, great. On live television, we started having a conversation with someone in the space who knew we were there, who was answering our questions. Yes, no, I don't know. On command. On live television in front of millions of people watching. And it was because we had humanized what was there and we genuinely wanted to have a conversation. I actually forgot the cameras. In that moment, I forgot that we were on live television because we were making such a connection.
Right. And it's bizarre investigating on live television because, first of all, you're investigating the entire time. So you're just kind of going about your business and then suddenly the camera operator is like, they're coming to you. And there's this twinge where you're like, oh, okay, now
set up straight, look busy.
Yeah. And but in that moment, like, I don't know. So for people who are not familiar, we used to quite often use this technique with flashlights where we would line up three flashlights in a row. The only reason we've stopped using this technique is since Maglite introduced their new like LED lights, it just doesn't work the same anymore. And slowly but surely, every single one of our old Maglites is burned out. If you want to help us with that, Maglite, if you're listening. But
this episode is sponsored by Maglite.
Maglite. But so what we did is we used this flashlight technique where we would set the flashlights to where they were. It was very easy to turn them on and off because you twist it. So and people would use one flashlight a lot, but we didn't really feel like that was a very controlled situation. So we would use three flashlights. And we would first establish they actually wanted to interact using the flashlights. And then when it was clear that they could answer us, we would have them pick which flashlight wanted to be yes, which wanted to be no, which was like, I don't know. And this is happening on live television.
Bizarre.
And it was like clockwork. Like we were having this entire conversation through these lights. I think we were on screen for like a solid 20 to 30 minutes doing this, which is like unheard of in these live shows, but it just wouldn't stop. And whoever was there was able to talk through the lights, recognize the lights, who like that's a universal signal, right? Everybody can speak through lights. And they wanted to talk. They were eager to talk.
Yeah. I remember when it was done, I think the camera operator was not only was his shoulder killing him at that point, but he also did not understand what was happening. He was like, what was that? Because I think the crew for the live show wasn't our normal crew. It was because they were all union.
Yeah, they were all like, they were used to shooting like football games.
Yeah.
Live TV, and they did not know what they had signed up for.
This guy's eyes were bigger than his head. And he was just like, what was that? How did you guys do that? And we were like, we didn't do anything. All we did was ask questions. Girl, we did some crazy stuff on live television.
Yeah, we did. Like I said earlier, that was my first F-bomb on live television. Oh. When you say an F-bomb on live TV, you hear the IFBs of every camera operator. Like somebody screaming in the control booth. Yeah. And
There was another time, I can't remember if we were investigating in a different section, but we had walked through and they kept saying that the windows had giant like screens on them, heavy screens.
Oh, right.
And so sometimes they would, you'd hear them like knock or bang. And we were just walking through, investigating and calling out just to see if it was there. And it was like, shoo, like the loudest sound I had ever heard. And we tried to figure out what it was, couldn't figure it out, not an animal. It was like somebody had taken it and slammed it. And we knew we weren't welcome in that moment. We were like, we're not welcome.
It's a location that I think every time I've been there, it's, again, a sad and terrible location, but it from a paranormal activity perspective, it seems like it always delivers in different ways. There was one time, actually, I was there with a paranormal event, and it was a group of people in one area. I forget all of the building names. I think they call it Dietary. It's like in the back of the grounds. And the session was coming to a close, and people were doing an investigation, and somebody walked by me, and then standing next to me was two of the volunteers that assist with the investigation. Someone walks by me, and they walk into another room, and this is sort of the free time of the investigation. Time winds down. It's like, okay, time to wrap it up, move everybody to the next location. And I'm like, oh, well, let me go grab the person that moved into that next room over there. And the volunteer is like, yeah, someone walked in there. Walk into this room. No one's in there. Walk into this adjacent room, and there is no other exit. And myself and the volunteer are like, I know we both physically saw someone walk in here. And instead, against this back wall was a very like distinct shadow kind of like hunched against the wall. And it reminded me in that moment of the final scene of the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, the worst.
Which I want to tell you all that I'm Mr. Brave at every moment, but that was a moment where I was nope the F out of there. I was like, nope.
Isn't that where when we were doing, somebody was doing the walkthrough before, right when we got there for the live show, and they saw a gentleman that looked like a worker?
Oh, that's right.
Is it Chris Williams? Did she see it?
It might have been Chris.
Because she was like, I saw there's a man standing there, like getting ready. It's like a worker. And they were like, nobody else is back there. And she came over talking about like, oh yeah, there's a guy back there or something. And there, and the guy was like, no, there's nobody back there.
Yeah. No, it does not surprise me.
There was another time I was actually filming. It was right before all of the COVID lockdown. And I was filming this. It was about haunted houses, but it wasn't a paranormal show. It was about haunted house attractions. And after a very long night of filming, everybody's very tired, winding down, waiting to get cut for the night because it's removed from any nearby hotels. It's definitely like a cab ride. And I'm standing outside facing the admin building. No one is in this building. And I'm standing next to a sound guy or whatever. And we're just chatting like, yeah, long night. Like, where are you going to go? You're going to grab some dinner, hit the local pub or whatever afterwards. And we're facing the admin building. And you see this lone wheelchair just cross past the threshold.
Nope.
And I'm like,
nope, get out of there.
Looking at each other, like, you saw this, right? Yep. Should we go in there? No.
Yeah. And for that reason, I'm out.
So that is wild.
Something that a lot of people just don't know. So you and I got to explore Pinehurst during the day.
That's right. Oh, that's right. We did a photo shoot there. We dressed in really fancy clothes and took pictures in Pinehurst.
Yeah. So, as one does.
Yes.
You know,
we were in our magazine.
Yeah. it's on the back of one of our magazines. It's the double duo image where it looks like we're kind of floating. That's Pinehurst. And I remember being there during the day. And of course, things in the daytime when sunlight hits it, you know, you see it in a different way. And I remember we got to actually take the time and really stand in a spot without cameras and like look. And at times it felt really creepy and intense. And then at times there was this weird, destructed beauty about it. But then you could see what kind of life it had. Like the beds were there, all lined up still. Like people had been in these little sections and cubby holes. And you just knew what kind of like, you know, little town or life this place had.
Exactly. And I think that's important. And that's kind of, I think, one of the greatest byproducts of what we do and what you all do is that we are kind of realizing that history. You know, we're not pushing it aside. We're not forgetting it existed. I love the new kind of outlook as we investigate these places that we're uber respectful of what happened there. You know, we're not going in, you know, antagonizing. We go in with deep respect and sympathy. And I think that really not only helps us as far as kind of gaining interaction, but I think it helps them. They, you know, you walk in as a living person and you're showing them respect they might not have ever had in life to begin with. So I think it's important that these places are explored. I think it's important that we learn the history that happened there with before we ever got there. And I think that, you know, regardless of how anyone feels about the paranormal field, there are places like this that are being remembered because of us. And so we have great responsibility. And that includes where we're going tonight as well, since we're going to Waverly Hills. So I want to thank my friends here for joining me today. And I want to thank all of you for this. And I hope you enjoyed it very much. I'm Amy Bruni, and this was Haunted Road.
Haunted Road is hosted and written by me, Amy Bruni, with additional research by Taylor Hagedorn and Cassandra De Alba. This show is edited and produced by Rima El-Khayali, with supervising producer Josh Thane and executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Haunted Road is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. Learn more about this show over at grimandmild.com. And for more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks,
Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.